of alcoholic. If you'd join me in a moment of silence for those who'd like to leave. I'm a little emotionally sensitive, so if you get up while I'm talking, I'll have to do a lot of inventory and okay. I'm grateful to be sober tonight. This is really weird. Thank you, Jamie, for your share. I'm really nervous. Thanks, Larry, for asking me. Sorry to tell you I'm an alcoholic. I'm probably way more alcoholic than most people in this room. I feel things a lot deeper than most people in this room. I have a lot more realistic problems than most of the people in this room. My resentments are real. My pain goes really deep. Okay, so spend a little bit of time on what it was like. It's kind of pathetic. I'm only really a big deal in my own mind, but I'm going to share my experience with you. And you had it set for him, didn't you? Okay. So, you got like a dinger or a timer or something? Because I might be all over the place here. You got something? Cool. All right. I only got 5 minutes. Holy shit! I'm gonna try not to swear. I already kind of blew that one. I don't remember this. It wasn't a blackout, it was because I was too little. But I was told by my parents, and they thought it was funny, that one of my first actual words was booze. And I'm old enough where it was normal practice to, when a child, a little one, is cutting teeth, they rub whiskey on their gums. Now, some of you are way too young to have had that done to you, but yet you're still here. But for some reason, I don't remember ever pointing to the booze cabinet and saying booze, but I remember the squeak and the warmth of when that whiskey would get rubbed on my gums. It went all the way downhill from there, and I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous in 2003. So I would have worn a shirt that fits if I knew I was going to speak. So here's the way my drinking went. I like to sneak drinks. From a very, very, very early age, I was taking sips. And my parents used to have margarita parties. And I used to stand on the step stool and hit the button on the blender. And then they would come in and they would pour the drinks, and there was always a little bit of slush left in the bottom of the blender. That was mine. And I was less than 7 when that was happening. My alcoholism has absolutely nothing to do with my parents or how I was treated or what I was told or how many times I was spanked or any of that stuff. I metabolize alcohol like you. A normal person doesn't crave it after they drink it like I do. So when I was about 7, I don't have a plan tonight, so I'm going to go deep, all right? When I was 7 years old, my grandfather killed himself. And this is the part of the story that's not funny. He was my hero. He was a great big, always seemed happy to me guy. He played the harmonica, which is a lot less sexy now than it was back then. And I can remember there's going to be some physical stuff that I do up here just to give you an idea of what it was like for me when I was a little guy. He used to go to the refrigerator, and they might be retro, they might be coming back into style now, I don't know, but there were these like 16 or so ounce aluminum cups, and some of them were colored, whatever. He had one of these cups, and he would walk to the refrigerator, and I would be, you know, running behind him, and he would open up the refrigerator, and he would pour a tall, all the way full glass of vodka, and I'm watching him from behind. And he would snap his fingers behind his head. I didn't have any idea what that meant until later. Ease and comfort. He was seeking to change his perception. He was seeking the effect produced by alcohol. By 8 years old, let me backtrack just for a second. When I came home the day that he committed suicide, my mother came into the house and she told me that he was in heaven. And I kind of had a grasp of what that was. Now remember, I'm like 7 years old. A couple days later, I overheard my dad on the phone saying that it was self-inflicted gunshot wound. I also knew what that was. And a couple of things happened in that moment. One was my parents lied to me. They didn't tell me the truth. That rolled and kind of became its own demon, and about a half a second later, I realized that I wasn't good enough to tell the truth to. Seven. No one ever told me I was worthless. No one ever told me I was unlovable. No one ever sat me down and told me any of that stuff. I also knew in that moment that if I would have been a better little boy, my grandfather would still be here. I didn't know any of that stuff until I took an inventory. But that's a hell of a load for a little guy to carry around. I don't know. I don't have any kids. I can't imagine telling a seven-year-old the truth in that situation. And I don't know what, I honestly, at this point in my sobriety, I don't know what the alternative would be. Maybe someone else has experience with that. I don't. So what that did is it set up a really, really deep-seated belief about myself. So now I've got this ammunition, and I'm going to roll with this. So over the course of time, like 8 years old, I was banned for life. Banned for life from a roller rink. Behind drinking. Somehow, I had got a hold of two little plastic bottles, and one had tequila, and one had triple sec. I don't even know what triple sec is. But I had both, and I was drinking them like this. I got caught. I got in a lot of trouble. My parents had a big meeting with all the other parents. They asked if anyone in the room thought if there was a problem. I was the only one that raised my hand. As far as I know, none of them are in Alcoholics Anonymous. Just me. Just me. I'm really grateful for that tonight. So, now I've got this deep-seated belief about myself, and it's not good, and I'm already getting in trouble behind drinking. And there's very little social occasion for eight-year-olds to drink. It's not a real popular thing to have going on in your house, so I'm sneaking drinks, and I'm doing it every chance I get. And we moved to California. I was born in Minnesota. We moved to San Diego when I was about 12. I really want to say a bad word and then look over. I So we moved to San Diego when I was 12, and I immediately kind of fell in with people like me, people who were bringing beer to school, and I never smoked pot before. That was actually a lot easier to get a hold of than booze was, and so I started on that path, and I'd still drinking every chance I got. Got in a lot of trouble, stopped going to school. When I was 17 years old, I had accidentally not gone to the entire first semester of my junior year. Not one class. And they called the house, and unfortunately, my dad answered the phone. Yeah, that didn't go over well. And so then I was kind of, time's up. I was kind of escorted for a couple days in a row to my high school, and I still wasn't going, and I was getting really, really loaded every single day, and I didn't know the language. I didn't know that I had an allergy. I didn't know I was obsessed. I didn't know that I had a spiritual malady. I just knew that I had to do it every day, and my mom asked me one morning, I probably hadn't slept in a couple of days, and she asked me one morning if I'd ever thought about hurting myself. Now, she has already gone through the experience of her father killing himself. So, because I'm a jerk, and not because I was loaded, but because I'm a jerk, I said yes. And when I got home from ditching school that day, I had a little duffel bag packed. And I was brought to a hospital. I was not on the alcohol drug rehabilitation side. I was on the other side, where you can't have your own scissors. And I was there for whatever, like 21, 22 days, something like that. And there was a psychiatrist assigned to me. I don't know if there's any people who have higher education here, but I still don't understand this. He used to throw tissue at me in the group. Anybody? Still haven't got an answer on that one. I'm still waiting on that one. So on the day before I left, I had a little one-on-one with him, and I already knew how to lie and tell people what they wanted to hear so I could, like, cruise. And he asked me how I felt about leaving the facility. And I said, you know, I'm a little afraid. I sure don't want to drink and do drugs anymore. And he's nodding his head. And he goes, you know, I don't think you're an alcoholic right now. But if you have one more drink, you will be. So, I knew one way to prove him wrong. It's the only thing I could think of, actually. There's only one thing I could think of to prove that guy not only had no right to throw wadded up tissue at me in group, but he had no right having that degree. He had no right saying that to me. I knew I was an alcoholic, so I started drinking again. And I thought, here's the really messed up part. I thought I decided to drink. I was way beyond choice before that. Now, when I thought I made a decision to take that drink after I got out of the hospital, I was sober. Hadn't had any booze in me for 3 weeks. Hadn't had any medications, hadn't had any street drugs, hadn't had anything in my system. So I was like, I was pretty sober. And with that sober brain, the best I could come up with was to drink. So I went to AA for a little bit, drank a lot of coffee, ate a lot of french fries. That's what we did back then. We went to coffee shops after the meeting, stayed up really late, and I would... It was weird because after I had been sober for a while, dry, whatever you want to call it, I would start to physically feel better. Hydration helps. Getting food in my body helps. Being able to sleep a little bit, that all helps me feel physically better. As soon as I start to feel physically better, that 99.9% convinced I'm alcoholic starts to slip. And after it starts to slip a little bit, that desperation starts to kind of go away, and I don't really see the point in doing an inventory. It's fine for you. I already feel better. There's really no point in me going on with all of this. Thank you very much. I'm fine. And I would hold out as long as I could, and then it would come time for me to drink. And again, I'm insane when it comes to alcohol. I thought I was choosing to drink. The obsession had me way before I took a drink. It was all I could do to just kind of hold on for as long as I could. My experience with Alcoholics Anonymous is I would only come here when I was forced to or when there was trouble looming, basically, you know. So really, for a long, long time, I thought that Alcoholics Anonymous was a punishment. This is where I come to atone for what I've done. And it was kind of weird because I would come into AA for a while and there would be these old guys with gray hair. sitting in meetings and they would stick their hand out to me and they would offer me help. And I didn't want that kind of help. You know, I kind of needed a job and a place to live would be really nice, but this whole sponsorship, God, inventory, steps, that's a little seems a little extreme to me. So in and out I went over and over again. Got worse every time. Got much worse every time. And I would come back into Alcoholics Anonymous and it would be a year and a half to 3 years later. And I go to the same meeting, and the same guys were in the same chairs, in the same meetings, and it used to just bug the crap out of me. Like, they never go anywhere. They just sit here and wait for me. It's a little self-centered, maybe, but, whatever. I got hurt at work in 2001. I fell off a roof and messed my leg up really, really bad. And I was out of work for quite a while. And I was sober when I fell. Or I was dry. I wasn't drinking that day. And I was out of work for about a year and a half. I fell in February. I was 2 days away from closing escrow on my first house. Called the realtor first and got out. And then I called my wife and told her what happened. And the subtle foe that it talks about in the big book, insidious, all that kind of stuff. That started really kind of creeping up on me. And in August, I got almost a $40,000 settlement. I still couldn't work. I wasn't released to go back to work yet. And I really couldn't hardly walk. By December of that same year, I was living in an apartment with no electricity. I still don't know where I got them. I had multiple car batteries, which I don't know where they came from still. And I would take them to different Kragans and charge them up, and then I would run my lights for a little while on inverters. I got two cars repossessed. I was being evicted. The hallucinations that I suffered from while I was doing what I was doing out there, they weren't helped at all by knowing that the sheriffs really were coming at some point. So by December, By December, there was nothing left. I don't even have the hustle to go get the batteries charged anymore. And what I was supposed to do is I was supposed to go. I lived in El Cajon, right by Parkway Bowl on Cuyamaca and Fletcher Parkway, right there. And I was supposed to go to Arizona, somewhere in Arizona, to a house that was owned by some church, and I was supposed to dry out. That was the plan. It wasn't my plan. That was the plan that was given to me. And someone else paid for a U-Haul, and I put my nasty bed and what crappy clothes I had left and my two cats and my wife in this U-Haul. There's only a few out-of-towners here tonight. I'll tell you after the meeting. But from Fletcher and Cuyamaca, which is El Cajon, heading to Phoenix, somewhere, I guess, in Arizona, I made it to 70th and Alvarado. It's the wrong way. And the wheels fell off. Some really bad stuff happened, and I knew right down where that old belief about me that I'm unlovable and I'm not worth it, right next to that, this thing started to happen where I knew I was alcoholic. And I wasn't relieved at all that I finally knew that. Like, I really knew that. I was terrified. And so she got behind the wheel and split, which was the best thing that could have happened right then. And what I did is I walked up the hill to my sister and her boyfriend's little trailer, and they were tweaking tiny, tight little circles. And I called someone. I called one of those old guys that was in AA with the gray hair. I called one of those guys, and he had the same phone number. Still had the same number. And I said, I need help. And he kind of laughed. And he didn't offer to sponsor me this time. What he offered was his couch and his phone. And it was my job to immediately start calling facilities because at that point I was a homeless male alcoholic who had no resources. Literally, I had nothing. Everything before that whole U-Haul thing that I could trade, sell, pawn, cluck, whatever, it was all gone. If I could plug it in or somebody else wanted it, it was all gone. So I started making some phone calls. And I ended up downtown at a little 10-day treatment deal. I'm going to get sober now. Am I good? Ended up at this little 10-day treatment thing, and there were some guys who were walking around with these blue hats. And it had white lettering on the front. And we have traditions here. The place is in Campo. And they don't have horses. It's a ranch. So I decided, being whatever, 12 days sober or something like that, my plan is that's where I'm going to go. And I told one of these guys who had one of these hats. He's the guy that I called for help. And I said, I'm going to this place. And he goes, really? Why don't you fill out 4 applications and give God a multiple choice? Now, I would have been totally fine doing that, knowing that the end result was what I wanted, but I didn't know that. So I filled out 5 applications, and I ended up going to that place up in Campo. And what happened while I was up there is... There was this really loud, obnoxious guy from Puerto Rico who I really respect, who made being up there kind of fun. and I appreciate that. And you did a good job with me. Thank you. There was another guy up there. He's here tonight. His name's Rich, and he would go up there once a week on his own dime, and he would read to us out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he would stay afterwards, and he would let us read our fifth steps off to him. Plus, he would answer all of our questions before we did that, while we're trying to write it out. So he was kind enough, and thank you, Rich. You made a big impact in my sobriety, and I appreciate you. He set aside time, and he listened to my chicken shit little force. Oop, I swore again. He listened to it, and I don't know if you even remember this. Probably not. I don't expect you to, really. I am kind of a big deal, though. There was a staff member. There was something going on up there, and it was a birthday or something, and there was a staff member. We were sitting on the bench, and the staff member kept coming and talking to you while I'm crying and reading off my inventory to you. And I'm getting pissed. Like, he knows what I'm doing, but he keeps interrupting me, right? And Rich is a very kind man, and he's, yep, that'll be fine. He's not being rude, but he's kind of like, he's letting the guy kind of get cut off short. And and when I got all done, the guy finally went away, and I had everything written down, and they give you those little tiny yellow tablets like this. That's what I did my first four step on, sideways, this way. When the guy finally left, Rich went like this and gave me his pen. And I got to the last page, and I wrote down some more inventory on there real quick, and that guy made it on my four step like that. And what's really cool is I knew what to write. I knew what to write. That affected my pride. That instilled fear that I'm not worth it. I'm not worth this guy's time. I'm not worth not interrupting. I knew how to write that stuff down. So now I'm at this ranch, and I've done a fifth step. And the next week, I worked in the kitchen up there, and the next week, the newer guys are coming in, and they're asking Rich questions about how to write a four step, how to write a four step. And this made a huge impact on me. Rich said, you should ask him. And he pointed at me. So my little inventory was... I learned how to do it. I learned how to do the inventory, and I learned what I'm looking for when I did that. And I appreciate you. My little plans and designs while I was up there was I was going to cut down enough mustard weed to get a big fat wad of cash, and I was going to go down and I was going to save her. Didn't work out. They asked me if I want to go down and fill an application for this men's recovery home in South Park, and like I didn't, I had $6, so I went ahead and I did that, and while I was waiting to go down to this other place, I got a letter from her, and it told me everything that she thought about me, and I went into the office, and George was in there, and I what I needed right then, what I thought I needed right then, was for people who were sober much longer than me to talk me down, to assure me that I was the best rancher ever, no one slopped pigs like me, and no one raked dirt like me, and the place just couldn't get along without me. And I went in there and I told him what was going on, And Mike, he did this, and he goes, you know what? I really don't think that you're getting everything that this place has to offer. Maybe it would be better for you if you went down the hill and did whatever and do whatever it is you think you have to do. And if you survive it, you can get back on the list and come back up here. No. You didn't do that right. So I left, and I think it was about a year later or something, I saw George, and he goes, hey, you know what Mike did after you left the office that day? I'm like, no. He went like this. He hooked me. He hooked me. He gave me a little moment of clarity of how really bad my plans are. They're terrible. Still, they're like really, really bad. So I got to that other place. I stayed there as long as they would have me, and then I got to go to this other place, and I got a full-time sponsor, and I did another four-step. And when I did... when I did that four-step, there was a... no one interrupted me, so it went a little smoother. And for the first time, like I was already, like in the process of working the steps, I didn't believe they were going to work. And if you're afraid to start the process because you're afraid it's not going to work, or if you're afraid to start the process because you think it will work, you're really cheating yourself. You're really cheating yourself out of something amazing. I didn't have any kind of like flash of light or anything like that when I finished my fifth step. What I felt was a part of. I felt hope. I told them everything. I told them the couple of things that weren't on the paper that I was kind of holding back on. And he tricked me before I started. He asked me to pray before I started. He tricked me. And when I prayed, the fear of letting it all go went away. That's my experience with that. I went on to 6 and 7, and I'm still in a recovery home, and it's really hard to get that hour when you live in a recovery home, and I get like 10-15 minutes at a pop, and I knew that I was thorough, and I knew that I was fearless, and I knew that I was ready to go on. And it was not until I started making my amends that I felt free. And I didn't even know what free felt like, really. If you're drinking at 7 years old, and your life is just an absolute mess for basically the whole time until you're 32 and you get sober, freedom is fleeting at best. I thought freedom was enough cash to get whatever I wanted, or the right job, or the right place, or the right her, whatever that was. I had no idea what true freedom really was. So I'm going to give you. I'm going to share an experience with an amends. I told you I was going to go deep. I don't have any kids, like I said earlier, but I have a nephew who I absolutely adore. And he's graduating from high school, and he's going to college. And I went out to see my dad in Florida. Just to see him, but also because I needed to make amends to him. And my dad is a good man. He's a hard-working man. He drinks a little much. Some of my first memories are of him taking me fishing. And he lived in a place in Florida where they had kind of little canals. It's in Hudson, Florida. And I was sitting on this little porch patio thing in the back of his house, and him and my nephew were standing down by the water, and he was showing my nephew how to tie a fishing knot. And I could see me right there. And then this horrible flash of my life from being a little guy to right to where I was right then, and how I had taken advantage of him, and how I had robbed him of not only cash but emotional security, and how many nights he couldn't sleep because he didn't know if he was going to get a call. You know what I mean? A mooch. Living on his couch when I was in my late 20s. You know what I mean? Real great son. And I knew that was the moment. I prayed about it, and I talked to my sponsor about it, and I knew that was the moment. And my nephew grabbed his fishing pole, and he went down and started fishing. And I made him the amends to my dad. And I own it all. Now, the hard part, what I was taught when I make an amends, is after I own everything, is to ask them if there's anything that I forgot. Is there anything that I've left out or anything that you need to tell me? And he told me that my slate was clean. And grace is an undeserved gift. I've done absolutely nothing to deserve my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hear a lot of people say that they drank enough to get here. If you only drank enough to get here, you're a pussy. Sissy is what I meant to say. Sissy is what I meant to say. I drank way more. I drank way more, way longer than I had to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was powerless over alcohol before I went into that hospital. I was beyond human aid before I went into that hospital when I was 17 years old. I'm powerless over alcohol right now. I have been given the tools that I need to tap into a power, and that power keeps me sober. I had a kind of an upbringing where I was given education in things religious, and I don't have anything against what your beliefs are. I had no way, even with all that information, I had no way to establish a personal relationship with God, and the steps have allowed me to do that. They've allowed me to clear away enough of that, what I told you guys about, that that belief about myself, that I'm not worth it. I'm not worth sticking around for. I'm unlovable. It's enabled me to recognize that for what it is, and it's enabled me to clear away just enough. Sufficient means just enough of that for there to be room for God. And the longer I stay sober, the more painfully obvious it is that I really need God. My life is not, first of all, I never thought I'd be sober this long. My sobriety date is February 7th of 2003. I never thought that I would be sober this long. Having been sober that long, I thought it would look a little different, to be honest with you. I thought I'd have shirts that fit, less gray hair, more stuff. I thought I'd have more stuff by now. So what happened, relationship stuff, and I've been struggling. And what happens when I get full of fear is it gets harder and harder for me to pray. I think maybe God's, maybe not got all the information. Like, I know he'll keep me sober. 100%. I know it. The other stuff, maybe he needs help. You know what I mean? A little bit of input. So I took it to my sponsor, and he does this thing with me, and it really bothers me. I'll be talking to him about some really serious things. And someone will walk by and say, "Hi, Jeff." And he'll go, hey, what do you think about Dave? Now, I would rather you hit me in the face with a hammer than compliment me. And he did this over and over again. Oh, my God, it bothered me a lot. His suggestion was to... this has grown into something that I didn't think it was going to with a lot of guys that I'm really close with. He asked me to ask God to allow me to see the good that other people see in me. So I was in a lot of pain, so I was willing to take a suggestion. That's how it kind of is with me. And I went home that night, and I did it. And it was one of the hardest things I've ever done in sobriety. It was to choke those words out of my mouth. Which seems kind of silly, probably. Try it. It did not go well. A week later, I was sitting with two of my best friends at dinner, and I told them what his suggestion was. And they said, I'll do that with you. So there was three of us. And we started doing this little check-in thing, right? I prayed up, prayed in, all in, whatever. We just do this little check-in thing with three of us. And there's 16 of us that are checking in with each other on a daily basis. Nothing's changed in my life. Not a single thing has changed in my life except for how I see it. There's 16 other guys, and all, like, whoever wants to talk about it after the meeting, there's room for a lot more. What it's done is it's given me a blanket. A safe feeling that there's that many guys who are all doing exactly the same thing at exactly the same time for exactly the same reasons. And we're all here in AA at a meeting right now, but I don't, it may be different for you, but I don't feel like always super connected to everybody in a room. I don't like most people, to be real honest with you. And I thought I was bad because that's how I felt. And I found out that I don't have to like everybody. I do have to be kind and tolerant. And I do my best to do that. So I'm going to close with this. I'm almost done. I said earlier that what this is grace. This is an undeserved gift. And I don't know if I'm going to get another chance at this gift. It's been offered to me many, many, many times, and I have I turned it down over and over and over again. This may be my only shot, so I'm going to do what I can to hold on to it. And it's kind of like this. If I told you right now that I can give you everything that you need to be safe and comfortable for the rest of your life, all you have to do is pick how you want it wrapped. Could you choose? That's the deal. This thing works every time. I've never met anybody who has done this to the best of their ability and gone out and gotten drunk. They stop doing it, and that's what happens. So if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length, and we're not going to tell you what any length is yet, if you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you will do this. And I'm sorry I wasn't him. I really appreciate everyone who stayed. God bless. Thanks.